You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. This is the Orthodox Nationalist here on Radio Albion. Of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of June 15th, 2024. I have some very good news for everybody. We have adopted a kitten, bringing the number of cats that I possess to an embarrassing number, a purebred Turkish Angora, bright white, I mean shockingly bright white, long hair, of course, 6 weeks old, named Chubba Purdy, and she has one blue eye and one yellow eye. Got her from a family a couple of hours from here. So if she causes any trouble, you'll know. She's extremely confident. There was no adjustment. She didn't go and hide or anything. She just came and took over, which is pretty common for that breed. And in a completely unrelated note, today's topic, it didn't dawn on me last year that it was the 50th anniversary of the coup of Augusto Pinochet in Chile. And I've taken some heat for saying nice things about him, even among nationalists and conservatives, because it's believed that he instituted a series of what amounted to neoliberal reforms. I have a book, at least partially on this topic, Inter Arma Einem Silent Leges, The Record of Anti-Communist Military Governments in Latin America, and Chile is one of the chapters. It was only meant to be a fairly brief introduction to the topic, nowhere near anything comprehensive. But the chapter on Pinochet today, and I've also published this elsewhere very recently, is revised, rewritten, and has tremendously more detail added to it. Now, the Latin phrase that I uttered, Inter Arma Einem Silent Leges, is very important. In fact, it's the thesis of the entire book. In times of war, the law falls silent, which, by the way, was also the title of a Star Trek episode, which I didn't know. And I think the consensus is that phrase was first uttered by Cicero in one of his orations, talking about what happens when civil order is upended. He's one of the symbols of the dying republic. And basically what it means, what Cicero meant, was in times of great civic unrest, great violence, normal judicial functions can't exist. They can't function. And maybe soon we'll talk about El Salvador and how the government there successfully smashed their gangs, which dominated the entire society, which, of course, as we could have predicted, earned endless condemnation from the U.S. But judicial procedure develops in time of peace. In America, it was a monoracial aristocracy. But starting in the early 1970s, the massive crime wave, which really never went away, the drug issue, the gang issue, and the collapse of order to the extent where the Chicago government just asked them nicely if they could not kill as many people. And of course, God knows what they gave them in return, which is what previous governments in El Salvador also did. that normal juridical functions can't function in that, institutions can't function in that circumstance. They were not meant to function in that circumstance. It's sort of like saying that every soldier in a war should have his own lawyer, and you could decide whether he should be shot or not. At the time when Cicero uttered this, of course, mob violence was everywhere. That means that power, politics, and even meaning was decided by deviousness and violence, not debate, which in turn destroys any semblance of civic virtue. That is to say, reasoned debate without personalizing it. You think of the cartels that run Mexico and the communist insurgencies that tore that continent apart, Central and South America, far more dangerous than anything that Cicero faced at the time. And this is why liberalism is so absurd juridically in these places. A system of procedures and juries and everything else is irrelevant when you're dealing with drug cartels far stronger than the government itself. So, like Cicero, I'm using that phrase and titled the book with that to denote the fact that institutions designed to operate in times of peace can function and should not function in times of war, especially at the civil level, and especially when the war may decide the very existence of the state itself. And I defend at least a handful of the many military dictators of Central and South America, and especially the thesis that they were supported by the United States, because they were not. So what I'm going to do today is a substantial revision of what I wrote in that book. And the first thing you have to take note of, Pinochet died in 2006. He ruled from 1973 to 1990. I've mentioned this before with Romero and El Salvador. It's almost impossible to find anything that defends Pinochet in your typical, mainstream literature. He's termed the most evil man in recent history, and of course, it doesn't stand up to any kind of analysis. Many of the things that are being published, especially recently, are just borderline unreadable. Cliched arguments, one lie after another, one assumption after another. They get repeated enough times, and it's seen as incontrovertible. But it's striking to some to argue that the U.S. did not, whatever the word support means, but did not support these governments and greatly distrusted them. Now, the word support, America has supported military dictators in Latin America. It's very vague what they mean by that. Possibly that they didn't put sanctions on the country, they didn't invade it. Of course, nothing like that happened to the USSR. Trade went on as normal for the most part. And whoever was ruling Chile would be treated the same way. Except, of course, Pinochet. Military aid was going to Chile no matter who was running it. And it was only later in Pinochet's reign that it was frozen. I said this relative to Suharto in Indonesia, too. I said it also General Park in South Korea. The scholars and journalists will tell you what the CIA communications say in the hopes that you don't actually read them. They're never very long. But when you read them, it shows that the U.S. did not trust Pinochet or any military ruler. But, of course, it was concerned with this endless cycle of bloodshed in this country. What the United States wanted were weak states, banana republic, not strong military governments or strong states at all. You read the CIA cables, and at least they're far more ambiguous and nuanced than what the left wants you to believe. Reading them and hearing what others say they say are two different things. There's very few that could show overt support for Pinochet or Suharto or anyone else like that. The U.S. opposes military governments on principle. What the U.S. backed was non-communist, but certainly liberal or vaguely socialist movements. A military government with a strong ideology, especially a popular, successful one, they're tough to control. And it means that the state is invariably a big part of the economy. When you're talking about strategic areas like Chile, who is one of the world's largest producers of copper, you see why the U.S. didn't trust these men. Military governments all over the world were attacked in the Western press and continue to be attacked today. They're considered illegitimate just ipso facto. Now, a military coup, most of you are familiar with the term, they come out of civil strife. They arrive at the 11th hour to stop their society's descent into insanity, violence, economic collapse. Their ideology is very rarely understood or even discussed. They're assumed to just be stooges of the landlords, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because they have their own source of financing and their own tradition and their own institutions. In Latin America especially, when the battle, you know, between communists and non-communists was tearing apart the cities, when the liberal government had absolutely no means to take action, or they didn't want to take action, the economy tanking, runaway inflation, many of the Marxist groups use drugs to finance themselves, and when it becomes clear that no one has the capacity to change anything, that's generally when you have a military coup. Because at that point, their oath to defend the country is triggered. Generally speaking, military governments seek a strong state that can run and guide a growing and focused economy, focused on what they do best, while, of course, at the same time ensuring the end of any insurgency. They tend to be patriotic, nationalist in one form or another. They dislike great wealth. They dislike the oligarchy. They tend to be from the lower classes. But ultimately, they originate in civil violence that the liberal parties have no hope of or no desire to control. Liberal governments usually are far more brutal and violent than military ones. But when you're dealing with academia and when you're dealing with journalism, these are leftist activist centers. That's their purpose. So their assumptions distort everything. I cite my favorite book title from Hugh Ossossi in 2000. Shaughnessy, I should say. Pinochet, The Politics of Torture. That's a very typical title. Another one is The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. These melodramatic titles. I mean, these men feel free to indulge themselves this way, knowing that no one of substance is going to, in their world anyway, going to challenge them. There's so many of these. They seem to compete with each other for the most lurid descriptions. He's accused of kidnapping, cocaine dealing, mass murder, killing kids, whatever they say, whatever they need to say to create moral outrage. So you not just have Johnson's Law here, you don't have a whole lot of people who can comment on it. I don't believe I'm an expert in Latin America, but I certainly am in military governments, which has been a concern of mine since I was a teenager, you know, early college. But also ideologically, coming to Pinochet's defense will cause you a tremendous amount of trouble. Therefore, these people can say whatever pleases them. General Pinochet personally was genteel. He was well-educated. He was very civilized. What most people don't know was that his promotions, especially when he became a general, and he was given command of the garrison of the capital city, Santiago, it was Allende himself. Salvador Allende was the socialist Marxist. He committed suicide after the coup. And he was in power up until 1973 when Pinochet took over. He trusted Pinochet. He promoted him all the way up to commander-in-chief. Now, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, the Chilean version of that. In 1971, communists murdered Edmundo Zoykovich. You see these strange ethnic mixes in Chile all the time. Allende appointed Pinochet to increasing powerful positions, including the entire capital region. There was a handful of restrictions, like curfews that were placed on some of the big cities. But Allende's Socialist Party and his openly Marxist policies were becoming extremely unpopular. He's elected in 1970, overthrown in 1973. In fact, he ordered Pinochet to stop all protests entirely, and he followed his orders. So he was promoted continuously by the man he will eventually overthrow. Eventually, the legislature turned on Allende. He was censured. It was a leftist revolutionary movement that was, and we'll talk about the so-called election here in a minute, that turned into mob violence. Violence grew all over the country. The economy was in an absolute shambles. Allende either would or could not act decisively. So, September 11, 1973, the Chilean military ousted his government. It was sort of elected in 1970. He even had been given the option to leave the country in peace, but he refused. Allende's suicide is probably the only thing that he ever did to benefit the country. The bodies, both in the coup and in Pinochet's reign, the body count was very low, especially when compared to his communist counterparts. His target was armed leftist guerrilla bodies. The fact that he was successful, the fact that he ran a fairly prosperous economy, that's why he's hated. Margaret Thatcher, in her speech, you know, Thatcher kind of liked Pinochet because he supported Britain in the war against Argentina. But Thatcher saw, and you know, Pinochet was eventually arrested and charged with genocide and nonsense like that. And stuff like that, and that was later in his life, long after he left power. And yes, he voluntarily left power. That was his symbolic revenge for the left's defeat in Chile. To attack and to hate Pinochet and those like him is almost a ritual that the left engages in to solidify itself. But Silvio Canto, a journalist in this area, said that it was the legislature and the Supreme Court of Chile that ordered General Pinochet to take over. It was quite legal. Pinochet never acted on his own. He formed a military government and found it very challenging to turn around a country that had been reduced to the lower reaches of the Third World. Allende was a communist because his movement was far more radical than the Communist Party itself. Paul Weyrich, who's an old friend of mine, he's been dead for quite a while now, was in Chile, I believe in the 1980s. He was organizing conservative forces there, pro-Pinochet forces there. And when Pinochet died, this is what he wrote about it. When I went to Chile, I was amazed to find freedom of the press. Far more than half the media was highly critical of Pinochet. At that time, of course, there was no opposition press in the Soviet Union. Indeed, in Chile, there was freedom of assembly. All sorts of groups and potential political parties were preparing for that resolution. And what he's referring to is the referendum that Pinochet called, which took place in 1988, that he narrowly lost. And as a result, he voluntarily stood down. He then became a senator. Near the end of his life, he was arrested in Britain and sent to Spain. They're extradited there. I should also note that Allende was a Freemason. He was a public member of the Lodge Progreso IV in the capital city and a few other places. That meant he was automatically not just making war on the country, but the church and any other institution that got in his way. His agenda was totalitarian. Pinochet didn't pretend to be an intellectual. He didn't pretend really even to be a leader. Bringing in Americans to teach him about economics, like Franco in Spain or even Assad in Syria, he did what he was forced to do under the worst of circumstances. He didn't want power. He didn't seek it. He was a soldier forced into a very difficult position. When an army is involved in politics, it weakens their readiness. These are soldiers. They're organized to defend the country, not run a bureaucracy. And it's laughable when the left starts talking about his election. Well, Arena was elected in El Salvador. Putin was. Lukashenko was. Yet these people were far more popular than Allende and certainly had a much larger share of the vote than he did. The way that the Chilean constitution worked at the time is you don't really have a runoff system. If you had three candidates for president and no one wins a majority, the president is chosen by the legislature. But somehow, with a very tiny percentage of the vote, 36.3%, somehow that won him the election because he was able to successfully lobby the legislature, who said that you, the only reason we're giving you this mandate is that you follow the Constitution, which of course he did not. Allende lost three presidential elections before he won, quote unquote, in 1970, 1952, 1958, and again in 1964. He won 5% of the vote in 1952. That was increased to 28% in 1958, and again 38% in 1964. The person the U.S. backed was Eduardo Frei, who has German background to him. He was a liberal of a sort, but that's exactly, I mean, the CIA spent a fortune on his campaign. He was fluent in English. He lectured at Columbia, all the typical marks. No one disputes he was financed by the CIA, but he was completely different from someone like Pinochet. In 1970, there were three major contenders. Jorge Alessandri, who was a former president, also chosen by the legislature, by the way. And Radomiro Tomic, both represented different factions of the Christian Democratic Party. Tomic was of Croatian origin. He was the leader of the leftist branch of that party, while Alessandri represented a moderate branch of it. But here's what the American Undersecretary of State said in 1970, Nicholas Katzenbach. He said, "I've heard that the Chilean communists are less radical than the socialists. Tomic's idea of a coalition of the left may not all be that bad. At any rate, it's worth further investigation." Tomic, by the way, was also a devotee of liberation theology, and like so many of these guys, had strong ties to the USA and the CIA. Again, the race in 1970 was decided by the legislature. It took a long time to come to they made all these deals, he had no mandate. He never did. He had to assure Parliament that he would abide by the Constitution. So when he didn't, Parliament removed the mandate they had given him. I think he got the nod because Tomic backed Allende's candidacy in the legislature. It's hard to deny that the coup in 1973... you can't deny that it was supported by the majority of Chileans. Two-thirds had voted against the ending of the 1970 election. But due to his policies, there were demonstrations in the streets against shortages of basic goods, massive inflation, high unemployment, which they laid at the feet of Allende. Now, he knew that he was unpopular. There was widespread opposition. So he went to Fidel Castro, and they wanted essentially, I guess what you could call a self-coup. Castro began sending very large quantities of weapons to arm his supporters, various leftist parties. Pinochet, being aware of this, moved more quickly than Allende. In other words, he was going to take over the government, Allende was, to remove the legislature, to remove the courts. And because of that decision, that's one of the many reasons the coup took place. Unidad Popular was the party that Allende ran under. It's actually a coalition. And it contained many Leninist and Maoist elements. As soon as this man got the mandate from the legislature, and even before, the Marxist violence escalated. They even set up no-go zones in various cities. And someone like Allende, and even some of the more, even some of the Leninists didn't like this idea. They wanted to put a smiley face on socialism. He couldn't control or didn't want to control his own coalition. They did whatever they wanted. And so when you have an already fragile economy, that was the end. And it put the army in a bad position. Pinochet had to move against the man who had promoted him for the last 3-4 years. The Constitution was ignored after Allende's election, and the lodges found themselves in control of the capital city. So, had Pinochet's coup not taken place, Chile was looking down the barrel of a civil war. I want to quote, I think this is a libertarian publication, February 1999, called Liberty. An article by John Coben. I never heard of this before. I found the website. It's actually a long-standing libertarian publication. I want to quote him here. We're talking about Pinochet. He says, "The world rarely quiets itself from wars and other conflicts, and a few wars can be called just from a classically liberal perspective. Like America's war for independence or the war between the states, Chile's struggle against the communists was a just conflict. The revolution in Chile was an act of self-defense against legal looters and armed bandits. As is inevitable in any war, errors were made, innocent lives were lost, but despite its mistakes, the revolution left a positive legacy. Chile has a free and prosperous economy and stable republican institutions. This is a context in which the British arrest of General Pinochet, the leader of Chile's revolution, must be judged. When Pinochet took over, Chile was experiencing a rapid decay in the quality of life. Salvador Allende had been elected president in a three-way election in which he won a minority. As I said, 36.3% of the election decided by the legislature. And immediately set about making himself into a dictator of a socialist country. There were reports of Allende killing dozens or even hundreds of people in the countryside. He was stealing and nationalizing private property. There was 1,000% inflation during his 1,000 days of rule. There was hunger, especially for those who were not in with the socialists, and it was not uncommon to see people without shoes." Now, for all the alleged support, that's the end of that quote. For all the alleged support that the U.S. gave Pinochet, there was no defense of his movement. The State Department never mentioned anything about Allende's killings, or anything else he was doing. They didn't write papers, they didn't write books explaining Pinochet's success. The CIA didn't bring Chilean writers who backed Pinochet, translate their works into English. He was banned from the U.S. in the 1970s. At the same time, Soviet technicians were being invited to study at MIT. And of course, these questions are never asked. I want to continue with them, with the quotation here. Hector Javilla, a Chilean professor who lives through these chaotic times, recalls, quote, "You had to wait in line for hours to get a piece of meat you couldn't eat," end quote. By July 1973, Allende had centralized control of nearly everything, including replacing the top two men in every firm with a bureaucrat. In short, Allende was destroying people's lives, and Chileans had a right to defend themselves against him. There were massive demonstrations calling for Allende's resignation. On August 22, 1973, the Chilean Chamber of Deputies passed a resolution of censure against Allende. Congressional deputies condemned him and his government for violating the Constitution and the law in order to, quote, institute a totalitarian system absolutely opposed to the representative system of government that the Constitution establishes, and called upon the military to intervene. According to the report of the respected Rettig Commission of the Democratic Aylwin government, there were 1,173 deaths, including military personnel, both during the revolution and during its aftermath, from September to December 1973. So this commission, the Rettig Commission, concluded that overall, over 17 years, the number of deaths were 2,033. That is leftist, probably understated, but it's pretty good for 17 years. The commission discovered about 265 deaths of military men at the same time. This includes people killed by leftist terrorism, civic unrest, whatever. Under the leftists, of course, this number would have been much higher. Now, the majority of these people, whatever the number might be, they were members of various armed Marxist parties. There was a movement of the revolutionary left who explicitly dedicated itself to violent revolution through terror, something called the Manuel Rodriguez Front, which has also had the same agenda. They weren't civil society groups. They were a set of armed cells, armed by Castro. Any of these parties, large or small, on the far left, had their own armed units. What few realize is that after 1973, the KGB, very upset by this, instituted a full campaign to discredit Pinochet abroad. It was called Operation Tucan. I found an article by a Ukrainian named Nikolai Shevchenko. I'm going to quote him here. The KGB forged correspondence between Pinochet and Miguel Contreras, head of Chile's National Intelligence Directorate. One of the letters detailed a plan to assassinate Pinochet's political opponents who were in exile in the U.S., Argentina, Mexico, France, Italy, and Costa Rica. Well, other letters implicated the CIA in the conspiracy as part of the infamous Operation Condor, a U.S.-backed campaign of political repression in South America. Now, that last line isn't true, but the point is the Soviets were forging documents. Many of you may remember Jack Anderson, a columnist for the New York Times, among other things. He took these letters as genuine. And he spouted this nonsense to the world. Years later, Anderson found out that he was duped. And in fact, KGB had fabricated the story. A lot of this comes from Vasily Matrokin. Many of you know him, a former KGB agent who defected. He sent a bunch of stolen papers to the UK embassy in Riga, in Latvia. And one of the, he had a few bags of documents, and one of them was, he had smuggled this out of the KGB archives in Russia, in Moscow. But one of the papers was on Operation Tucan, the campaign to discredit Pinochet, specifically in the eyes of the American public. And the man who okayed it, shouldn't surprise anybody, is Yuri Andropov, head of the KGB at the time, and will be a very ineffectual dictator of the USSR for a short time. And here's what Shevchenko writes concerning these papers. At the crux of the operation was the intent to feed prominent American journalists and human rights activists discrediting information concerning Pinochet's atrocities in Chile. I want you to keep in mind, too, that Shevchenko, the writer here, is an opponent of Pinochet. Now, I probably don't have to tell you guys that Marxist parties, if they had succeeded, if the Allende government had succeeded, either his entire coalition or part of it, they would have set up a totalitarian state, tightly censored the media, destroyed the economy, set up forced labor camps, and engaged in mass executions as a matter of ideological cleansing. And since every Marxist-Leninist state has done the exact same thing without exception, Even the legislature said that this is what AND was going to do. But even if the numbers of those killed by the military were undercounted, it's tiny. Given the violence, given the developing civil war in Chile at the time. Even liberals were calling for Allende's ouster after his 1,000 days. His behavior was completely outrageous. The Liberty article, I'm going to quote them one more time. Now, this meaning 1999, the British have arrested Pinochet at the request of a Spanish court, seeking to prosecute him for various offenses committed during the revolution. He stands accused of genocide and murder. And everyone knows about that. Western news media seldom reported the terrorist activities of the communists that Pinochet fought, and Pinochet gets very little sympathy in Europe or North America, which, of course, is an understatement. The truth of the matter is, since the leftists were defeated, the revolution stomped out, they'll use and continue to use every weapon in their disposal to make the army's action seem arbitrary and killing innocent people for no reason. The regime is uniformly leftist and liberal of one form or another. There remain very, very few voices against this cliched story. How many deaths has Marxism, Leninism, Maoism caused in the world? Somehow, though, you know, the left has a lot of cognitive dissonance about this. They tend to defend it. And they tend to defend it in the sense that anyone who fought it is considered an evil man. There's a journalist in Santiago who wrote, again, the flurry of writing after his arrest in the UK. This is what he says right after Pinochet was arrested. Most people we have talked to are uneasy in Chile itself. They're sad. They're outraged about the arrest of Pinochet. Recent polls put popular support in Chile for Pinochet's release at over 75%. Alvaro Vial, academic vice president of the Finisterre University, who frequently writes on Chilean political issues for the national press, said that he believes that perhaps 40% of Chileans would firmly stand behind Pinochet. There are probably another 30 to 40% who support his return to Chile. The vast majority of Chileans want him to be freed. There are frequent pro-Pinochet demonstrations in front of the British and Spanish embassies, which occasionally turn violent. The boulevard in front of the Spanish embassy is at times sealed off, and that embassy, along with the British ambassador's residence, continually barricaded. We think Pinochet's supporters in Chile have a good point. To charge Pinochet with murder would be as unjust as charging Patrick Henry or Thomas Jefferson with murdering redcoats, or with accidentally shooting their neighbor while trying to kill a redcoat. All such revolutionaries act in self-defense against an oppressive state, and their cause is just, despite the tragedies and accidental loss of innocent lives that might occur. The media in the United States and Europe have distorted the facts regarding Pinochet. He stands accused of murder and crimes against humanity. And that's the beginning and end of the story, as far as the journalists are concerned. But CNN and the international news media in general rarely reveal details about the terrorist activities of the communists that Pinochet was fighting. Because of their mostly leftist bias, most media do not sympathize with Pinochet or his revolution against armed socialists who pushed the country to civil war. Thus, the media portray Pinochet as a senseless and brutal dictator and ignore the circumstances in which Pinochet assumed power to prevent a bloody, protracted civil war. The left doesn't give a damn about innocent deaths. Their track record shows it. It's simply a rhetorical device. Ideology and economics are at the center of the Western establishment's uniform position on Pinochet. It isn't so much that he saved the country from civil war, but in the process defeated the radical and armed left. The death numbers there over 17 years were low, and yet only an idiot can say that he's guilty of genocide. But that's the extent to which governments in the Western world will go to back leftist forces worldwide. No one in power condemned the arrest of Pinochet then. Castro killed a heck of a lot more Cubans than Pinochet did Chileans. But the corporate NGOs like Amnesty International were the ones that were pushing for the general's extradition to Spain in 1998. But justice was hardly the concern. Castro was training guerrillas and sending soldiers around the world, making civil wars even worse. But not only is the regime silent, they actually, especially in universities, openly praise him. Chile is the most successful case of economic and political development in Latin America, although I happen to think that El Salvador might soon overtake them. Compare Chile's condition to Cuba's. Let me continue quoting him now. Pinochet and those under his command almost certainly were responsible for the death of innocent people. In the chaos and confusion of war, such tragedies are inevitable. Those outside the fray would do well to hesitate to pass judgment on the fallible human being swept up in the vortex of war. Pinochet was not pure, no one could be, or has ever been, under such circumstances. Pinochet carried out an economic and political revolution that successively devolved power away from the state. Afterwards, he voluntarily stepped down from power. In doing so, his successors agreed to give him immunity from prosecution for misdeeds committed during the revolution. To us, this seems like a reasonable arrangement. The revolution was over, peace, prosperity, and a stable republic stood in the place of chaos, poverty, and dictatorship. Pinochet was no tyrant. I mean, do tyrants usher in more freedom? Do they relinquish their power voluntarily? Pinochet did both. What an absurd precedent Pinochet's arrest sets. Monsters like Zaire's Mobutu, Cambodia's Pol Pot, and the dictators of the communist countries of Eastern Europe were never harangued by world tribunals in the press. But Pinochet, who voluntarily stepped down from office and now continues to serve his country as a member of the Senate, is arrested when he visits Britain. Every war affects innocent people. Sometimes, like the Allies in World War II, they were deliberately targeted. But I don't know who innocent is, and neither do you, and neither do the people on the ground. It's a matter of rhetoric. The fact that we have to remind the people of the world of this fact is absurd. It exposes the cognitive shift the regime has promoted when dealing with rightist and nationalist leaders versus their leftist friends abroad. To walk into a university and claim that one is a Maoist will not lead to any repercussions, despite the fact that Mao's policies directly caused the deaths of tens of millions. And I've never gotten a straight answer from any academic as to how this could be. It comes down to the fact, I mean, you go and you praise Hitler, you praise Pinochet, and you're not going to last at that university. You come and you praise Mao, it's a totally different story. Yet, the university in America is the very sort of totalitarian society these academics want to impose on the world. Essentially, they're taking advantage of public ignorance. They demand that a civil war be prosecuted without bloodshed. You know, one of the most ridiculous terms is death squad. That was created by the Western media only when describing the tactical units used by right-wing government. Using that term is ridiculous. So, of course, they set up impossible standards for their enemies, but glory in the carnage of their friends. But the whole point of scholarship is to rise above these petty pleadings and to penetrate the truth that's hidden in the rhetoric. And, of course, none of these guys know how to do their job. And they'll continually defend or at least remain neutral on the mass slaughter of Leninism or Maoism. Any attack on the left, especially since World War II, which gave much of the world to Stalin, is met with the most irrational hatred and derision. And there's very few exceptions to this. Then they project those very same feelings onto their opponents. Bloodshed is inherently part of the leftist political ideology, especially Marxism-Leninism. Violence and cleansing is a theoretical necessity. It's built right into the leftist ideology. Force is a part of their entire theoretical edifice. They need to cleanse their society of reactionary institutions. For nationalists, violence is really just an unfortunate byproduct of the fact that those leaders are not perfect, and their enemies are often extremely violent and often don't wear uniforms. It's not built into any sort of nationalist ideology as a matter of philosophical necessity. But the rise of very well-armed and well-funded Marxist movements worldwide forced the right in its various guises to defend themselves. The regime's reaction to the Vietnam War is just one of many examples. North Vietnam bragged about their slaughter of civilians, And that's swept under the rug, where they have to invent massacres by Americans against innocent people for no reason. The word innocent is really non-empirical. Of course, the very elderly, the very young, no one really argues that. What it seems to mean is non-combatants are being deliberately killed, but that could just mean a communist revolutionary in jeans rather than fatigues. Journalists don't have any way of knowing if these people are innocent or not. It's just an ignorant stereotype. No government, no nationalist government, especially one that's struggling like Pinochet for legitimacy and popularity, and of course being notoriously poor in propaganda, would begin killing random people. They're not cleansing anything. It's not part of the edifice like it is for Marxism. This is what the dictatorship of the proletariat is. Well, I've made the argument since I was in college. I've made the argument, kind of goes like this. In general, military governments, when they're properly motivated, outperform liberal democratic ones in terms of economic growth, social stability, social justice, and overall popularity. I've given the list, you know, Taiwan, South Korea, Indonesia, Thailand, post-communist China. Africa, of course, an exception, but no government seems to work there. Chile is part of the record enjoyed by Taiwan and Korea. It's difficult. Shouldn't surprise anybody. It's difficult to get a solid statistical reading on Chile during Pinochet's rule. There's active drives to repress these numbers. There's not much in terms of statistics other than the World Bank. But there's certain things, you know, the cognitive dissonance of the regime goes like this. Pinochet was evil, but wages skyrocketed. Pinochet was evil, but all economic indicators went through the roof. Pinochet was evil, but infant mortality almost became non-existent. That's not an enviable position to be in. But inventing numbers and statistics is not uncommon. This dissonance is usually resolved by, you know, typical ad hominem attacks, threats. Any student who backs Pinochet, or as in my case back then, Franco, you're going to have a hard time. Professors can't cognitively deal with the fact that militaries in the Third World rule far better than liberal democracies. Now, according to the World Bank, the GNP of the country between 1975 and 1990 rose from 35 Chilean pesos to a whopping 9 trillion, which is a huge increase no matter what currency you use to measure it, controlling for inflation, which only the army was able to bring down. Not mentioned all the time is that Chile enjoyed one of the highest savings rates in the world. Only Japan had a higher one. This is one of the ways you know that the left is lying about the economic growth under Pinochet, because savings is very closely correlated with high rates of economic growth. Not to mention it helps control interest rates. What we mean by savings is consuming less out of a given amount of resources in the present in order to consume it possibly in the future. It is connected to economic growth. It is certainly connected to local investments, since low savings rates tend to invite foreigners to invest in the country, since locals don't have the cash needed for this. It was a book by Elton Rayack, which was not a bad book, but there's a section on Chile in it. The book is called Not So Free to Choose, The Political Economy of Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan. He is one of the originators, came out in 86, that there was no Chilean miracle. GDP went up maybe 1% yearly from 1975 to 1980. And Marxists, you know, repeat this all the time. They won't touch the World Bank numbers, but they'll use that. The World Bank, now measuring in dollars, says that the economy increased by between 8 and 10% a year over 17 years. And at the same time, this success was done at a time of financial meltdown throughout the continent, with inflation out of control throughout Latin America. Even better, The World Bank and institutions like that were nothing but hostile to Pinochet and all those like him. So chances are the numbers are much higher. Pinochet was interesting. After the coup, there was a fairly elaborate process of deliberation, up until maybe 1975. He brought some Americans in, Friedman being one. He brought others in. He took their advice, didn't listen to everything they said by any means. But some kind of a social or national market had to be developed. This does not alter the strength of the state. Libertarians tend to condemn Pinochet in the sense that he was a statist, not because he was a capitalist. But like in Korea, a strong state, especially one run by a general, will keep the oligarchy from hijacking economic policy. It's a free market within a national state. It would always revise. It was always adjusted. The crisis of the early 1980s was a major shock. But the basic foundation was consistent. Thing is that since Pinochet stepped down in 1990, no one has advocated anything different than Pinochet's basic agenda. No one talks about state capitalism or Allende's version of socialism. Even hostile people like Alejandro Foxley, who was the finance minister right after Pinochet was gone, he said, "We may not like the government that came before us, but they did many things right. We have inherited a country that is an asset." Governments that came and went after Pinochet maintained the same structures. That's why some of these guys refer to the events of 1973 as a revolution. The socialist order was upended. Not a whole lot of people defended that order. Now, you do have those on the right that say that the Pinochet government removed the state from the economy. He took the ideas of the Chicago School seriously and literally. Yet, Pinochet was no neoliberal. And he rejected that model for Chile. Now, you all know that the most strategic industry in Chile is her copper mines. It brings a huge amount of foreign exchange into the country. Now, in the late 1960s, the mines were nationalized. Pinochet absolutely refused to change that. Even the banks, there was an ill-advised attempt to deregulate them in 1978, a few years later, Pinochet reversed that and brought them under state control between 1981 and 1982. Pinochet had to deal with a massive increase in poverty that the violence brought about, the planned socialism under Allende brought about. Pinochet's success is based on this combination of state-centered stabilization, basic structural reforms, and targeted social programs for the very poorest. So the phrase like national market or social market might not be a bad one. Pinochet was a statist. He was no libertarian. In the early 80s, you had huge increases in state spending for social programs that were targeted again for the poorest of the poor. Between Allende's violence and the coup itself, poverty had risen to about 50% of the population, 30% a few years later, and after he was gone, it continued to fall. In 2005, it was about 15%. But the Chilean establishment are more than aware that any success they had in dealing with poverty derived in large part from the foundations that Pinochet left for them. The basic structure laid out in the 1970s and 80s was kept in place by the moderate left who took over. The Chilean economy quickly recovered after the near war that Pinochet stopped. It became the largest and most complex in Latin America by the 80s. There's a few places called Chile the Switzerland of Latin America because of the peace and the increasing wealth found there. Fujimori in Peru tried to do, something very similar. But the regime says that Chile became a backwater, reduced to an oligarchy, under an army beholden to the super rich. But the opposite was true. The elites did not like Pinochet because of the strict controls that he placed on them. What kind of dictator permits votes in opposition to him? Weyrich already said that you had lots of anti-Pinochet newspapers. The only rigged elections now are in the West. I mentioned the referendum that he set up near the end of his reign. He narrowly lost it. He'd been in power for a long time, but he accepted the results. His was an era of peace. Maybe the army wasn't needed anymore to be in charge. Since then, all the far-left parties were destroyed, absolutely defeated in elections since then. Because the left, in that sense, can only take power by force. And that's what the coup was meant to defeat. Of course, only the most brutal of dictators leave their countries with huge trade surpluses and a well-managed economy. From 85 to 95, so on the foundations of Pinochet, last 5 years of his rule, the overall volume of trade rose from $3 billion to $16 billion yearly. Pinochet's brutality and arbitrary violence left Chile with the lowest infant mortality rate in Latin America. Shocking at 8 per 1,000 live births. The rest of the continent, 27 per 1,000 live births. The U.S. back then stood at about 7, England about 5.5, but before the coup, Chile was actually closer to the rest of the continent. The rate was about 25 per 1,000. Truth is that Pinochet and his brutality saved countless lives through stopping a civil war before it began. At the end of Pinochet's reign of terror, the literacy rate was about 96%. But when he left office in 1990, Chile went into a tailspin, went into depression, where the economy didn't grow for a few years. There is precedent. In other parts of the world, the only institution capable of controlling inflation was the army. The only reason that subsequent governments, post-1990, after the Depression was over, the only reason that any of them did well because they had the legacy that they explicitly maintained. And this is why Pinochet is very popular in the country today. He didn't clamp down on political dissent. Well, the left does, from the U.S. to the U.K. to Ukraine. The faculty lounge scribblers just generate one myth after another. He did what he had to do. He would much rather be a soldier. Who would trade being a lifelong soldier for being a damn politician? But those two things merged in 1973. He liquidated Marxist organizations who would have done to Chile what they did in China, what they did in the Soviet Union. Destroying Leninist Maoist groups by any way you can is an act done to preserve human rights, not destroy them. I hate it when you have these well-paid professors in their air-conditioned offices. They have the gall to tell a general how to deal with civil unrest, or a cop how to function in high crime areas, or prison guards how to function. I would love to see them in these situations. Because Pinochet's was not a totalitarian system, you had a robust civil society that Cuba never had. Only the Leninists were proscribed and prosecuted. That's the government's obligation. And the only reason Pinochet was in power was to accomplish this, since no one else could. If he's a brutal dictator, then thank God for it, since brutal dictators are the saviors of Latin America. The truth of the matter is that in 1973, September 11th, his coup was legal, accepted, and supported by the majority of the population, and at least some elites. Even the Christian Democrats, the largest party in the country, approved the coup. Even his successor, Patricio Aylwin, his successor went out of his way to approve of Pinochet's acts, saying that the army in 1973, quote, saved the democracy of Chile. You don't hear that every day. Of course, I'm pretty sure you can't find that in the American press. And I guarantee you, if I could read Spanish, I'll find a lot more things like this. But the only thing that matters as far as the regime is concerned is that the left was defeated. The left was stopped before they can take over. That means the left and the rest of the world will never stop until his reputation is destroyed forever. And as of right now, they've largely succeeded. And I hope that this, in some very small way, can change that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.